From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the summer of 2011, this country went to the brink of fiscal collapse. Washington could not reach a deal on what to do, so they pushed the cliff out to January 1st, 2013, the fiscal cliff that we're staring at now, with Barack Obama once again holding the White House, John Boehner once again Speaker of the House, and stakes high as ever. This hour, On Point, driving toward the fiscal cliff. You can join the conversation, what should be done here? How do we get or force or make a deal? How do we get a good grip on our fiscal future? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Noam Scheiber, senior editor at the New Republic. He writes big on politics and economic policy, author of the new book, The Escape Artists, about the Obama team's first term grappling with the economy and federal finance. Noam Scheiber, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Remind us of the parade of horribles that comes about on January 1st if nothing happens, Noam. First of all, the Bush tax cuts go away, so those taxes pop up. What else?
So all the Bush tax cuts go away. Then we have this sequester, which is $1.2 trillion in cuts over 10 years, split more or less evenly between defense spending and domestic discretionary spending, which is all the other things we normally think of as government, you know, FBI appropriations, Head Start.
Everything. This is sort of a blind broad axe across the board. Just lop it off.
Exactly. It's incredibly crude. It just takes everything down by about the same percentage. So that happens. We also have the expiration of a payroll tax cut. You'll recall earlier this year, actually late last year, Congress and the president agreed to extend the payroll tax cut by 2 months. And then in February, they extended it for the full year. That goes away also on January 1st. And then a little while after that, we're going to have to deal with the debt ceiling increase again. But fortunately, that doesn't happen on January 1st. We think we have till April or so to sort that out. So, eons by contemporary standards,
so
I guess.
If the Bush tax, I mean, the payroll tax, that would hit everybody who pays payroll tax. So that would be basically everybody.
Everyone who draws a salary, right. You know, any wage of any kind. Yeah.
The spending cuts are severe enough that Republicans, I mean, nobody sort of lined this out with the idea that it would actually happen. It was always designed, right, to be so crude and dumb that we would never let it actually go through. So even Republicans don't favor these cuts. Am I correct?
Exactly. No, and in fact, Republicans find the defense cuts especially, uniquely intolerable. And in fairness, they have a point. I mean, it's clear that there's some waste and inefficiency at the Pentagon that we can root out. I think everyone would concede that. But these cuts are across the board. Every program gets cut the same amount, whether it's an incredibly efficient, well thought out program or it's the oldest, crudest, most larded.
But in fairness, nobody thought these cuts would ever actually go through because they're so ham-handed, they're so stupid that this was put here exactly in order to force a deal of some kind.
Exactly. I mean, the thinking at the time was the dumber and cruder the cuts, the better. That will only motivate Congress to reach a deal. Maybe at the margins it did light a fire on them under them a bit more, but not sufficiently for them to actually sort it out.
Take us back, Noam, you know this terrain well, to why and when and why the fiscal cliff was built. How did we end up with this thing? Take us back to the summer of 2011 and what happened there.
Yeah. So the summer of 2011, there are basically two things going on at the same time. One is Republicans, this new Republican majority in Congress is absolutely adamant that we need trillions of dollars worth of cuts to federal spending over 10 years or so because the deficit and debt are out of control. At the same time, you have this debt ceiling, which is the limit on the amount that the U.S. government can borrow at any given time. Those things sort of converge in the summer, and the Republicans in Congress basically tell the president there is no way that we are going to raise this debt ceiling unless you agree to trillions of dollars worth of cuts. So they spend most of the summer, well, they spend much of the spring and summer negotiating in a variety of venues with a variety of negotiators, ultimately culminating with the Speaker, John Boehner, and the president himself. They come pretty close to getting a grand bargain, which would have been $4 trillion over over 10 years, including a little bit of revenue, about $800 billion, but mostly spending cuts. But the whole thing kind of collapses toward the end of July. And at that point, they realize, well, our grand bargain has collapsed, but we still need to do something about this debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
So they agree to a much smaller deal, a kind of $2 trillion, $2.1 trillion deal over 10 years that involves only spending cuts, no revenue of any kind. And the deal is broken up into two parts. One is $900 billion of discretionary spending cuts,
mm-hmm.
And that's the pot of money that that Congress appropriates basically from year to year. And the second part is this sequester, this crude instrument that we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's the $1.2 trillion, another $1.2 trillion over 10 years. And what they do is they set up this process called the super committee, and that's just going to be a committee of a variety of senators and congressmen, and they give them most of the fall to try to agree to a set of cuts totaling about $1.2 trillion, a little bit less if they can't get there. And if they aren't able to reach agreement, then these automatic cuts go into effect on January 1st, 2013. Well, they spent all fall of 2011 trying to reach a deal. They couldn't do it. And so we're where we find ourselves now, which is Plan B, these automatic cuts going into effect.
With all the cuts that you described, plus the end of extended unemployment benefits when there are still a lot of people unemployed,
exactly.
The end of reimbursement or reimbursement cuts to Medicare doctors would come charging in
the
AMT yeah.
The alternative minimum tax
would hit a lot of families that it hasn't hit before. I mean, combined, people are saying this could bring on real hard recession again. Are they not?
They are absolutely doing that. There is some debate in Washington over how steep the cliff is, whether it's a cliff or a kind of nice rolling slope. I think there's some truth to the fact that that the apocalypse won't strike immediately on January 1st, 2013. These cuts are slated to occur over 10 years. It's a lot of money, but it's also a long period of time. The Bush tax cuts also phase in, but of course, people pay taxes mostly on an annual basis, not on, on a sort of daily basis.
So it won't all hit at once.
It wouldn't happen immediately, exactly.
But you've got rating agencies, the Fitch rating agency, I think just yesterday saying, look, you still don't have your house in order and we don't see how you're going to get it there, talking again about cutting the U.S. credit rating.
Yeah, I think the ratings agencies are in a weird spot. I mean, on the one hand, the fiscal cliff would do basically what they want us to do, right? They would raise a lot of tax revenue. You're looking at $3 to $4 trillion over 10 years if all the Bush tax cuts go away. They would impose a lot of cuts, $1.2 trillion over 10 years, in addition to the $900 billion that we've already done. So that would do a lot for our medium term deficit, which is of course what the rating agencies tell us they want. They want to see. I think the problem from the perspective of the rating agencies is the obvious problem, which is that it would be a big hit to the economy, and if the economy slows, then tax revenue can slow.
And also, if I read them right, they were saying, you could do that, but it's dumb. It's a dumb way of doing it, and we need to see evidence that you've still got your head on your shoulders in the U.S. government.
No, that's right. It's interesting. I mean, ever since, I would say, early 2011, shortly after the Republican Congress was elected, the rating agencies actually have been making kind of an economic argument, but actually a political argument. And their political argument was basically, we don't think your political system can deal with this. You've got these Republicans in the House. You've got this Democratic administration and a Democratic Senate. We're just not convinced that you guys can get together and hammer out a deal. And if you read, what S&P in particular was writing throughout 2011, ultimately they downgraded us in August. A lot of the signals that they were sending were precisely that. We don't trust you guys to work this out. And in fact, I know this from my own reporting, when they would meet with Treasury officials, say, they would make that point very, very explicitly. We sort of buy your numbers in the abstract, but we have no faith in your capacity to get together with Republicans in Congress and make a deal happen. And the Treasury folks, a lot of whom had been there in the mid 1990s when Bill Clinton and a Republican Congress hammered a deal, would respond to them, well, look, I mean, people say a lot of stuff, particularly after they win an election. They kind of mark their territory, but what ends up happening is people sort of circle each other for a long time. Maybe there's another election, and they ultimately come together and work it out. And the rating agencies were very skeptical of that argument.
Well, I mean, here we are. We're on the other side of the election. There are more Democrats in the Senate, quite unexpectedly compared to what people anticipated just a few months ago. But the House is still Republican, still strong Tea Party bastion there. The president's still in the White House. John Boehner's still the Speaker of the House.
Yeah.
Have the politics changed in some substantial way that makes solving this riddle, this knot, easier?
I think they've changed a little bit, and I would say that for two reasons. One, obviously the Obama didn't win an overwhelming victory, a 50-48 margin, even though the Electoral College margin was substantially larger. Not a resounding victory. But,
okay, but it's a victory. It's
a victory. And I think the thing that White House people will tell you, and I think they're absolutely right to point it out, is the president very explicitly campaigned on ending the upper income Bush tax cuts. And if you look at the exit polling, the country was very much behind him on that. There was about 60% of the vote voters told the exit pollsters that they believed that taxes should rise on the rich. Now, some of them thought they should rise on everybody, but there's a 60% majority for raising these upper income tax cuts. So president campaigned on it. People voted for him, and they more people than voted for him actually said that this would be their position. So a certain number of people, not insignificant number of people who voted for Mitt Romney actually agreed with this as well.
And here we go.
Second thing is...
Yeah, hold the second thing. No,
yep.
No, we've got a break right here. We'll come back and grab it. We're headed toward that fiscal cliff now when taxes, unless this is tweaked, will go up for everybody. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about post-election challenge number one, the fiscal cliff, how Washington may, will, or may not deal with it. Noam Scheiber is with us, senior editor at The New Republic, author of The Escape Artists, How Obama's Team Fumbled the Recovery, just out, 6 weeks ago, sort of TikTok on those early days of recovery, and the big fight in 11 that left us with this cliff in front of us right now. President Obama, in his victory speech in Chicago, election night, said Americans voted for bipartisan action, not regular politics. Here he is.
In the coming weeks and months, I am looking forward to reaching out and working with leaders of both parties to meet the challenges we can only solve together. Reducing our deficit, reforming our tax code, fixing our immigration system, freeing ourselves from foreign oil. We've got more work to do.
The president talked about raising taxes on the rich very, very upfront all the way through his campaign. But John Boehner was looking at the results come in with Republicans still in charge of the House of Representatives. And the speaker said, he talked about a different mandate. Here he is.
With this vote, the American people have also made clear that there's no mandate for raising tax rates. And what Americans want that are solutions that will ease the burdens on small businesses, bring jobs home, and let our economy grow. Listen, we stand ready to work with any willing partner, Democrat, Republican, or otherwise, who shares a commitment to getting those things done.
Stand ready and willing to work, but exactly how? We're going to go to Capitol Hill in just a second. Noam, you had another point there. You said, number one, the president campaigned on higher taxes on affluent Americans, and two...
And two, yeah, I just think this time, mechanically, the way the process works gives him a ton of leverage. In 2011, he was really kind of up against a wall. He had to raise this debt ceiling, and the House wasn't going to do it.
Or we would default.
Or we would default unless the president basically met them, you know, most of the way toward what they wanted. This time, the tax cuts expire, and the president is perfectly happy to let all the tax cuts expire and then come back and just pass a tax cut for middle-class people, which Republicans, regardless of what they say now, would be very, very hard-pressed to oppose. So I think the leverage in this case is almost entirely on his side, whereas in 2011, it was really with the House Republicans.
No, stand by. Naftali Ben-David joins us right now as well from Washington. He covers Congress for the Wall Street Journal. Naftali, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What about this option, if it's an option? The president's got leverage here. If you just go over the cliff, the Bush tax cuts would expire. Then he could come back and reinstate them with that leverage in Congress for the middle class. So what's the view on Capitol Hill, Naftali, about just going over the cliff?
Well, I think that option's actually overstated. I mean, it sounds like something that could happen, but the truth is, I don't think any president or any congressional leader really wants to be seen as responsible for having taxes go up on everybody, even temporarily, for having these spending cuts start to take effect, for having the stock market probably tank, for having the country possibly go back into a recession. So I actually don't think that's going to happen. You know, to me, what was interesting was the extent to which the comments since the election have been conciliatory on all sides. I mean, you know, President Obama spoke about working with leaders of both parties. John Boehner's talk yesterday, I thought, was very conciliatory in terms of the language and the tone that he used. Senator Reid came out and said, look, I know how to dance and I know how to fight. I'm a better fighter than a dancer, but I'd rather dance. That was his way of saying he really wants to work something out. So we have to see where all this goes. But I think in the aggregate, the comments that have been made by both sides since the election suggest that the lesson that they took from the vote was that people want, they at least want to be seen as conciliators. We'll see what the next few weeks bring, but clearly that's the message that they took, is that the message people want to hear from their leaders is that people are looking to compromise.
That's an important distinction, be seen as conciliators. I mean, let's talk about Boehner and Reid. Here's Reid. We heard Boehner. Here's the, well, I guess he'll be the new Senate Majority Leader again, calling for fiscal cliff solutions at a news conference yesterday on Capitol Hill. Harry Reid.
Everything doesn't have to be a fight. Everything doesn't have to be a fight. That's the way it's been the last couple of years. So everyone should comprehend, especially my Senate friends, that legislation is the art of compromises, consensus building.
Okay, but let's get very real here, Naftali. We'll come back to Harry Reid and the Democrats, but the Republicans, yes, there was that compromising tone, but you heard no mandate for tax hike, and John Boehner knows very well that's where everything blew up last time. That's what the president campaigned on. So how do you get around that here? I mean, it was nice tone, but isn't the dagger still in the sheath there?
Well, sure. I mean, look, both sides have to walk a balance because they have to send a message to their strongest supporters and to their base that they're not just going to roll over. That's certainly true for Democrats because, you know, unions and others are going to say, look, you know, we helped you win. Now don't turn around and betray us. But it's true for Republicans as well. I mean, I think where a lot of this is going to come down to is the question of revenue. You know, John Boehner was very careful to say, look, we can accept a certain amount of revenue. But you know, what does that mean? Does that mean higher rates? Does it mean that we figure that if we reduce rates, there'll be more growth?
Well, that's what he said. He said today, he said growth, you know, grow to revenue, which seems a way of saying no to taxing to revenue.
Well, I mean, I think that's right. And that's certainly their opening position. And maybe that'll be their final position. You know, it's hard to know exactly where they're going to end up. But I think the noteworthy thing is sort of where they're starting right now. There's a lot of things people could have said over the past 48 hours that they didn't say. President Obama did not come out and repeat, for example, his requirement that the top two tax rates go up. You know, when Harry Reid was asked about tax rates, he said, I'm not going to draw lines in the sand. In a way, Boehner was the most interesting. He used a teleprompter for his comments yesterday, which he rarely does. And the reason for that, I think, is that he wanted to be careful that he got the words exactly right. He didn't take questions from reporters. It's almost like diplomatic language. You know, it's almost like the way diplomats talk when they're negotiations between different countries. So the signals that were sent out, I think, were positive and were in terms of compromise. Of course, you know, the rubber hasn't met the road yet, and we'll see what really happens in terms of revenues and also in terms of reforming entitlements or safety net programs. Those are going to be the two big issues, and you know, we'll have to see.
So let me ask
the way
you both,
deals are worked out.
Yeah, sorry, Naftali.
I was just going to say, the way deals are worked out in Congress tends not to be, you know, through public pronouncements. It tends not to be through summits at Camp David. It tends to be through weeks of quiet, behind-the-scenes talks between this staffer and that staffer, and then occasionally this senator and that senator. It's a little bit of a longer-term process. It's certainly a behind-the-scenes process.
Yeah, but you're describing
so
a process that we have not
comments.
Seen at all, Naftali. We haven't seen it at all. Americans have could have lost faith that that goes on there, and you've got plenty of congresspeople saying it has not gone on for some years here.
Well, it definitely hasn't. But the question is, have the dynamics sufficiently changed through the election that now it will? And to the extent that there are, you know, things that are motivating people toward a deal, it's the fear of what would happen from the ratings agencies and the markets, but it's also the fact that the election's over. You know, most of the past year and maybe more has been looking at this election, everybody wondering who's going to have power, President Obama not knowing if he'd be in office, Republicans thinking maybe they'd take the White House, you know, maybe they'd take the Senate.
Yep.
But now that's done. You know, the musical chairs have stopped. People have sat down in their seats. And if there's any positive sign, and I don't think that should be overstated, it's that people kind of know they're stuck with each other for the next 2 years, and there'll be a tremendous amount of pressure, not only to avert the fiscal cliff, but to reach a broader deficit deal over the next year or so.
Naftali Ben-David with the Wall Street Journal, Noam Shiver with the New Republic. I want to ask you both what a deal, a big deal might look like here, or little pieces of a deal that slowly comes together. I don't know. But first to our listeners, if I may, Craig in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Craig, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Everybody's saying it. We just have to start working together as fellow Americans and not for the good of the country and not for the good of the party. We're bleeding this country dry being so divided. We've got to quit being divided. There's entities that want to take what this country is all about away from us. And so we've just got to do this fundamental perspective, and that is work together as fellow Americans. It doesn't mean you have to compromise your agenda and ideology, but you can communicate, collaborate.
But what if your agenda does have to be compromised to make it happen, Craig?
Well, work incrementally then.
Yeah.
You can't get everything at once.
Yeah. So get real, please. The message out of Cedar Rapids. Craig, thank you for that. Let me get one more here. Julie in Savannah, Georgia. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling with a hope that Barack Obama is going to go into this next term with the full force of his convictions that I feel that he kind of muted in the first term for reelection purposes. I almost swung green this last election because I thought he'd kind of sidestepped his passion.
Mm-hmm. So go in hard, Mr. President. Go in full force. Don't start out compromising. Is that your message this time, Julie?
With the bull's nose, he's going in with the full force of the progressive movement.
Julie, thanks for your call. Okay, we've got many more there, but let's just take it. I mean, there's that voice that says from Iowa that says, please get a deal done here, guys. And then there's Julie, who saw the president go in looking for compromise in the first term. Noam, let me bring this one to you. And you saw what happened there. There are many in his party who said that didn't work so well, President Obama. Where's your instinct for go? Does he have more leverage? Should he go in? Could he go in harder this time with a hope of getting to a deal?
Yeah, I do think he has more leverage this time. And Naftali raised an interesting point, which is how deals actually get done. And I think there are sort of these two models. One is you quietly sort of work things out in back rooms and caucus rooms, and you don't make too much noise about it on either side. You give the negotiators space to do their work. That was a model that worked, you know, for decades and decades in this country. I think that model has broken down a bit. It certainly since Obama took office, but probably even before then, I would say during the Bush era. And I think the new model of how things get done, again, dating back to the Bush era, but certainly in this administration, is you've got to light a fire under your opponent's feet. And I think what
Obama has said as much, and I'm going to take this out to the people even after the election season. I'm going to campaign for what I want this time.
Exactly right. I mean, what you saw is Republicans were pretty intransigent for most of his first term, and he was only actually able to move them on certain things. If you take the payroll tax cut, for example, after those debt ceiling negotiations concluded in late July, early August of 2011, Obama put together another stimulus package totaling almost $500 billion. Republicans pretty much immediately said, no thanks. And what Obama decided to do was kind of take his act on the road. He spent a lot of time kind of barnstorming the country, talking about why the economy was struggling and how this could help it recover. He didn't get the full $500 billion package. It was about $450 billion. But what he did do was create, I think, a political momentum for the renewal of the payroll tax cut. And it became very, very difficult for Republicans to oppose that. I think had he not done that, had he not created this outside momentum for this thing to happen. Republicans had basically given every indication that they were not going to go along with this payroll tax cut extension. And I think there's a lesson there, and I think it's a lesson that the president learned, that as much as your impulses, and certainly Obama had these impulses, might be to enter into a sort of quiet, good faith negotiation and just hammer out a deal, it just doesn't work that way. You've got to build political support within the country for what you're trying to do and bring the other guys around to it when they can look at the polls, essentially, and where the people are and decide that this is in their political self-interest to do it.
Naftali, you're on Capitol Hill. Look at it from that end. If the president says, look, never mind so much compromise this time. I tried that. It didn't work. I'm going to take it to the people and use the leverage I've got after this election to sort of present House Republicans with a deal. How might that go down? Or is that not really what you anticipate, Naftali?
Well, I think I think you do both. In other words, I wouldn't see them as two distinct models, but as flip sides of the same model. Simultaneously, you go outside and make your case to the people while also negotiating quietly behind closed doors. And I think that is something that both sides are going to try to do. I think it's something that President Obama really feels perhaps like he didn't do well enough in the first term. He's talked about how he didn't perhaps put forth his message. He didn't tell a story. And I think what's going to happen is we're going to see both of people trying to make their argument publicly, even while they're talking together privately. But, I thought the two calls were fascinating because they show the difficult political terrain and they show the two sides of it. Each side is, on the one hand, going to have to deal with internal party dynamics and avoid a feeling that they're betraying the basic principles of their party, while at the same time compromising enough to reach a deal.
So what
it's
might
treacherous terrain.
It is indeed. What might a deal? Cast your mind forward. What might a deal that you could imagine this capital city getting to look like, Naftali?
Well, it's funny because, in some ways it reminds me of Middle East peace talks. Everybody knows what the big picture of a deal probably would have to look like, but the smaller details are, infuriatingly difficult to reach. I think there would have to be some kind of revenue increase that involves eliminating deductions, eliminating subsidies, probably involves raising tax rates on somebody. And I think on the other side, you'd have to have some kind of relatively thorough reform of the entitlement programs. We're not talking about vouchers. We're not talking about stuff like that. But enough of a structural reform that puts those things on a sounder
Medicare,
financial basis.
Social Security.
Yeah, exactly. Medicare, Medicaid. Those are kind of the major components. And when Boehner talked about accepting revenue, and other Republicans have said this both privately and publicly, what they say is we can accept more revenue, but we're not going to accept it unless we also get a satisfactory reform or overhaul of the safety net programs.
But Noam, there's a possibility, but Noam, that it hung up last time on exactly the revenue tax front, didn't it? John Boehner didn't feel he could get that through his folks on Capitol Hill.
Absolutely, yeah. There's some debate, about the final hours of the negotiation and who walked away and who was left at the altar. Mm-hmm. But I think that at the macro level, that's exactly right. What John Boehner was fighting the whole time throughout the summer of 2011, which was this absolute unwillingness of his caucus to go along with not even a tax increase. Even something that he could describe as a revenue increase through tax reform, through, lowering rates and closing loopholes and the combination of that and more economic growth generating revenue. He couldn't even sell that, I think.
So do you see a deal possible along the lines Naftali's just laid out?
I think it's hard. I think he makes a great point, which is you absolutely have to do these two things in tandem. You have to make your case in the court of public opinion. You have to keep the channels of communication open. I think the Republicans understand that what was kind of their ceiling in 2011 in terms of how far they could go has become the floor. Certainly you're not going to do less than $800 billion in revenue, and certainly some form of that is, I think, going to have to come in tax increases. I think the wiggle room and the room for negotiation will be, okay, maybe we don't raise taxes on everyone making over $250,000. Maybe we go up to $500,000. Maybe we go up to $1 million. Mm-hmm. You've heard certain Republicans mm-hmm. kind of, intimate that $1 million may be a place to go. Obviously, some of the interest groups on the conservative side, find that anathema.
We'll hear the harumphing in a hurry, but it would help them get away from the millionaires club kind of reputation with a stroke there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. talking this hour about post-election challenge number one, the fiscal cliff, how Washington may or may not deal with it. Noam Scheiber is with us, author of The Escape Artist. Naftali Ben-David is here, covers Congress for The Wall Street Journal. How do we get this country on the right footing, and a footing that lines up with the results of the election we just had? The people have spoken. Here's some comments from Washington in and around that election. Again, John Boehner, this was yesterday on Capitol Hill, a statement saying Republicans are willing to accept new revenue, but through entitlement reform and tax reform to avert the looming fiscal cliff.
There's an alternative to going over the fiscal cliff, in whole or in part. It involves making real changes to the financial structure of entitlement programs and reforming our tax code to curb special interest loopholes and deductions. By working together and creating a fairer, simpler, cleaner tax code, we can give our country a stronger, healthier economy. A stronger economy means more revenue, which is what the president seeks.
There's an alternative, he says, but it's about growth and revenue from growth, not taxes. Here on CNN yesterday morning, Democratic Representative Chris Van Hollen of Maryland said that by electing President Obama, the American people have voted for a balanced economic plan with maybe some different ingredients.
It's very clear from the exit polling that a majority of Americans recognize that we need to share responsibility in reducing the deficit. That means asking higher income earners to contribute more to reducing the deficit. So that was one of the clear messages. That was one of the central themes in this campaign. The president won, and I think it's important that Republicans on the Hill recognize that the American people have said balanced approach is necessary.
The president won, says the Democrat. Is it all dangerous? Well, you bet. Here's former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan painting an even bigger picture of the pain that may be involved.
I think this is a very dangerous situation, largely because there is a general presumption that somehow we can resolve this issue without physical pain or spiritual pain or any sort of economic pain whatsoever. This is a very difficult problem. I think we have to recognize that no matter how we resolve it, there are negative consequences.
Alan Greenspan on Bloomberg Television there. Donald Marin joins us right now. He's director of the Tax Policy Center, nonpartisan joint venture of the Urban Institute and the Brookings Center. Donald Marin, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So we're all looking at this fiscal cliff that's coming up end of the year, December 31st, January 1st. But here's Alan Greenspan weighing in to say, you know what, it's more than just this cliff. We're looking for the country here at physical pain, spiritual pain, economic pain. Is the conversation that's going on around these fiscal challenges, tuned up to the scale of the problem we're looking at, Donald?
Well, you know, we have a whole tassel of different problems. We have the cliff that's looming, which basically over the last 10 to 11 years, every tax cut that's been enacted has been temporary. They're all going to expire, plus the scheduled spending cuts.
Mm-hmm.
We have on top of that the knowledge that regardless of how this turns out, our tax system is fundamentally flawed. It's too complicated. It's bad for the economy. It's unfair. We need to address that. And then in the longer run, we're on a fiscal trajectory that doesn't work, that the growth path of spending in coming years is higher than the expected rate of revenues. We've got deficits as far as the eye can see, and that we somehow need to bring those closer together. So we have at least three major separate problems, all of which, pieces of which, are going to be talked about at least in the next couple months.
Well, who's talking then in your, if you're our nonpartisan referee here, who's talking most realistically? The president's saying through the campaign and right there on his victory night, deficits is the first thing he wants to address, is the first thing he names. Now, he also wants higher taxes on the wealthy, and there's a bunch of other stuff. John Boehner saying growth, and that's the way to go, and reform. Who's speaking more fully and candidly to the American public, in your view, Donald?
Well, so I'm not going to grade either side. What I will say is obviously, growth, if we can find a way to promote it, is the best way to heal our long-run budget problems. Growth increases revenues, and it also reduces some spending. But frankly, it's hard to generate growth from a lot of the types of fiscal policy changes that folks are talking about.
What do you mean by that? What are you referring to?
I think people in general, or some people, overestimate how much additional economic growth we could induce by improving our tax system or by reining in spending. It's certainly not zero. You can get some additional growth and better use of capital if we redesigned our tax
mm-hmm.
system. But it's not something that's going to be enough to fill in the large fiscal hole we have looking forward.
That's the what Boehner's talking about. That's kind of the Republican line, growth and fill in the hole with the revenue that comes off that growth. So then what about the president's line? Combination of longer-term spending cuts and higher taxes.
Right, so we got to rein in the growth of spending, right? So those are spending cuts off of obviously an increasing trajectory, particularly for healthcare. It seems almost certain, given what America seems to want in terms of social programs provided by the federal government, that we're going to need higher revenue in the future than we've had in the past. And then you rapidly get then in this discussion about, well, how can we generate that higher revenue? Do we actually have to raise tax rates, or can we get there by rolling back deductions and credits and other things that would count as raising revenue, but maybe not to some people count as increasing taxes?
Let's get a caller in right here, Russ in Plattsburgh, New York. Russ, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think one of the lessons from this recent election is that we're all ready to be treated as adults. We've come to recognize several truths. Truths, for example, the fact that the life expectancy is going up and people are using programs like Medicare and Social Security for longer periods of time these days. And people are ready to accept the fact that we may need to increase the age at which these things come into play. I think one of the problems in places like Greece is that the government has kept the hard truths from people for so long, and now they're taking it all away at once. I think we're ready to be treated as adults. We understand the problems, and we're ready for sensible solutions to them.
Russ, I appreciate your call. Noam, what are you thinking as you hear that? You know, is it a, still a you can't handle the truth, Americans, kind of situation? Or is Russ right? People are ready to hear it take the pain if Greenspan's right. Not that Greenspan's always right. He's been wrong before.
Suffice it to say, yeah. Look, I do think the public opinion is reasonably sophisticated on this. And, you know, I would just point to the fact that in 2010, during the midterm elections, the first time that the Bush tax cuts were expiring and we had to figure out what we were going to do about them, Democrats on Capitol Hill were incredibly worried about even suggesting that or having a vote on allowing the upper income tax cuts to expire. They just thought the public, even though people seemed to say that they would be okay with that, yeah, they were just incredibly worried
the
about
president
any sort
himself.
Of political reaction. President himself. I mean, they basically backed off of it, obviously, yeah, in 2010. You know, this time around, president went out and made his case and made it, you know, it was a somewhat complicated case. It wasn't just all, all strawberries and cream. And the public, you know, got behind him. I mean, they understood that we have, you know, it's not a question of sacrifice. Clearly, there's going to have to be some sacrifice. It's a question of who is in the best position to make the sacrifice and who's in a position to make more sacrifice than others. And I think the public understands that, you know, if you've done a little better, you're probably going to have to do a little more sacrificing. And so I'm encouraged by the way that he was able to sort of make his case and the public sort of responded to it. You know, on the entitlement side, obviously, you know, it's all fine and good until someone's own Medicare benefits get cut and then they get very upset. But look, I mean, the caller made the point about raising retirement age, raising mm-hmm. ages of eligibility. I think, there's a deal to be done along those lines, even potentially for Medicare. And the reason I think the White House is prepared to do that is now that it looks like, you know, the Affordable Care Act, you know, aka Obamacare, is here to stay. We now have a way for people to get health care. You know, even if they have a pre-existing condition, even if they don't have a job, even if they have a small employer that doesn't offer healthcare benefits.
Right.
And whereas before, those people, you know, if they were in kind of late middle age in retirement, close to retirement age, they were really, really needed to get to Medicare so that they would have healthcare benefits because they didn't have them. And Medicare is a great way to get it for them. Now that the Affordable Care Act is here to stay, they will have healthcare coverage. Most of them will. And so you can maybe talk about raising the eligibility age a year or two over a period of, you know, 20 years. It just becomes much more feasible with the healthcare reform in place that Obama passed.
Let's go to Ellen in Middlebury, Vermont. Ellen, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, I think one of the things that seems very odd or even disturbing to me, mm-hmm. is that we got into this problem because, you know, primarily the deficit problem. We had these, you know, big Bush tax cuts put in by Republicans, supported by many Dems.
Yep.
Bush's wars, again, put in by Republicans, but, you know, supported by a number of Dems.
Yep.
And even a Medicare bill where, you know, they didn't put in the bulk purchasing of drugs so that they couldn't control the cost
right.
of drugs like they do in many other countries. So all of this was done, but now when it comes to paying for this, it seems like they're asking ordinary people to pay, right, by some kind of change in Social Security or Medicare, which will, you know, impact a lot of ordinary people who will rely on these programs. And it seems, you know, one, you know, patently unfair. It doesn't seem to be brought up in many commentaries. And it seems like there are other ways out. You know, you raise the cap for Social Security. You don't pay on any income now over $110,000.
Mm-hmm.
You could finally do the bulk purchasing of drugs, which, you know, every Democrat has promised, but then they don't deal with the drug part of the Medicare bill. So why aren't these solutions being thought of, which would be less injurious to the ordinary people who didn't put in those terrible policies that got us there in the first place?
Ellen, let us pick up at least some of those. I mean, Donald Merrin, how are you processing that? You know, the GOP, Ellen says, dug this hole with tax cuts for wealthy Americans, favoring that. Why bail us out on the backs of the middle class and lower? What do you think about that formulation?
Yeah, so we have kind of three different deficit problems. We have that in the 2000s, we started running deficits because of spending and tax cuts. We had the financial crisis, which drove us up to gigantic levels of deficits, which is now in the rearview mirror and slowly receding. And then we have the longer run challenge that just because of the aging of the population and rising healthcare costs,
yep.
We're fundamentally imbalanced in the long run, even if those other two things had never happened. And so for addressing the long-run challenge, we somehow need to do something on the healthcare front, something on Social Security, and probably something on the revenue side to make everything work out.
So you're saying there's some of the burden that has to go to middle class, to everybody, and that justly sits there because we are the populace and we are aging and needing. Is that right? Or not.
Yes, and there's a limit to how much money on the tax side you can raise from the very tippy top of the income distribution. So, you start getting into these interesting discussions about what's the difference between a high-income person and middle-income, but if you use, say, the president's cutoff of $250,000, you know, you've got obviously a significant amount of income above that, but really the folks who earn, say, $75 to $250 earn a lot of income in this country, and if we're going to need to raise significantly more tax revenue, they're going to have to chip in as well.
Naftali Ben-David, what are you thinking as you sit on Capitol Hill, think about Congress people and how they look at all this? You know, Ellen says, you know, we didn't make this problem and we shouldn't pay for it. Are Congress people willing, ready to look at 75 to 250 income range and say you're going to have to chip in here? Or are they sharing Ellen's view that that's not fair, or they're just afraid to say it?
Well, I think it's really complicated. You know, there's this sentiment out there that the people, you know, in capital letters, are ready to be talked to like adults and they want results. And that's all fine in the abstract. But these members of Congress know that in their next election, they may have to run against somebody, maybe in a primary, who could hit them very hard as being, you know, a tax raiser or somebody who voted to gut Medicare or Social Security. So there's this conflict sometimes, I think, between this general sense of what people in general kind of want and are ready for, and what politicians know they actually have to face when they have to go to be reelected next time around.
Well, I mean,
and I think the dynamic that's most important is whether or not, you know, the overall desire on the part of the voting public is for a solution and for pragmatic results. If that overcomes the politics that push the other way, which are more often intra-party politics, and are equally powerful. And so I think that's a point that's often ignored. There's what sort of the public wants in the abstract, and then there's what politicians actually have to face in reality.
But what does that mean? Is it really the most important point? I mean, we all know about Grover Norquist's, pledge that he's got, an overwhelming majority of Republicans having taken that they will never, ever, 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 ever raise taxes as he defines that. I mean, is that the power of the public, or is that the power of, you know, some part of the base, or just Mr. Norquist?
Well, exactly. That's the question. I think both parties have these bases that can push them pretty hard. I do think, interestingly, about Mr. Norquist, I think his power is ebbing a little bit. You know, you're seeing more and more Republicans talking about repudiating the pledge, or that maybe, you know, he has a little too much power. The Democrats have very effectively, I think, used the idea that Republicans are signing pledges to him instead of to the American people. So that dynamic's going to be an interesting one, because he really has been able to wield quite a bit of power, particularly over Republicans, by saying, if you vote this way, you know, I will lend my prestige to saying that you're a tax raiser, and that could be fatal to you in your next election.
And has been to no small number. Donald, do you see the makings of something here yet? I mean, we've heard lots of people on Capitol Hill. John Kerry, I heard the other day, saying, absolutely, we're going to come to some kind of deal. Do you believe it? Do you see it coming together, Donald?
You know, I believe Congress will take some action. The history of Congress over the last couple of years is that they are willing to make policy when they face a crisis. So if we're going to default on our debt or shut down the government, you know, within the next 2 days, people are able to come to a deal. In this case, the question is really whether they're able to do something on the fiscal cliff, say, before Christmas, so they can go home to their constituents and say they've handled it, or whether, for some of the political reasons that folks talked about earlier in the show, whether they need to go over into January. But they'll address it in some way, probably not a permanent way.
Noam, grand solution here, or the kind of incremental chip away at it to dodge the bullet?
Well, it's a really interesting strategic question, and actually I think this is playing out on the left between the administration and different progressive groups who are much more skeptical about the idea of beneficiary cuts to Medicare. Mm-hmm. You know, the people on the left say, why would we broaden this thing out into this grand bargain where we put Medicare in the mix and Social Security? Really, we have two immediate problems on January 1st. We have these tax cuts expiring, and we have this sequestration, these crude cuts. We can solve both of those basically at once. We end the upper income tax cuts. It's about $800 billion, and that takes care of most of the sequestration, and we're done. We all go home. So I think you're going to see that play out. The administration kind of wants a big deal. People on the left want a smaller deal, and you'll have to sort that out on the left before you can deal with John Boehner.
Well, eyes wide open and clued in, thanks to the three of you. Donald Marin at the Tax Policy Center, thank you very much for being with us today, Donald.
Sure thing.
Naftali Ben-David with the Wall Street Journal on Capitol Hill. Thanks so much, Naftali.
Okay, thanks for having me.
And Noam Scheiber, the New Republic author of The Escape Artists. Thank you, Noam.
Thanks so much.
Here we go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.